Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A truck driver crashes into a group of motorcyclists in Randolph, killing seven. The budget passes the legislature and faces Governor Sununu's veto pen, and Attorney General Gordon MacDonald makes his case for why he deserves confirmation to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. We also have a video of this conversation available, and you can watch it on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And you can see everybody in the studio with me today. That includes Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landergren, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
So, sad news to start the show today. We've been talking about this all week. It's been all over the news. The crash that stunned the state made national news. Seven people died when a young man driving a truck carrying a trailer killed seven people on Route 2 in Randolph. Among them, five men who were members of the Jarheads Motorcycle Club, a club for Marines and Fleet Marine Force Navy Corpsmen. The outpouring of support for these people and their families has been really profound. Frank Couture drove up on a Goldwing with his wife from Methuen, Massachusetts. They've been driving through New Hampshire all day, all their favorite routes, but their destination was the site of the crash on Route 2.
Came all the way up here just to see this, just to show our respect. I would have rode for 10 hours if I had to come and see this. This is just so sad. You got to show your respect for what happened here. It's sad, dude. There's no need for this. Nobody should have to go through this.
A common sentiment about the crash that killed seven people in Randolph. Kevin Landergren, you've been reporting on this for the Union Leader. Take us through what we know about the crash. What happened last Friday?
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, law enforcement has been somewhat very cryptic about all of the details, and I think it's because they want to, from the very beginning of this, when this crash happened, we weren't even sure about the driver of the truck and whether he was alive. But state police, typically when a fatal crash happens, and especially when both parties perish, law enforcement gives a lot of detail about what happens, because at the end of the day, nobody is culpable at that point. Nobody can be charged. So we could tell right from the beginning, this they were treating this as a crime scene. We know Volodymyr Zhukovsky was driving this truck, carrying an empty flatbed trailer.
Zhukovsky, the 23-year-old who's responsible, allegedly.
Right. Yep. And he was heading west on Route 2 in Randolph and somehow crossed the center line and then jumped back into traffic, into his lane. And apparently, as he did that, and it was according to witnesses who were driving behind him, he did it quite abruptly and at a very high rate of speed. It caused the flatbed trailer to jackknife across the road. So even though he came back into his proper lane of traffic, this flatbed trailer just covered the entire other lane. And that's when it clipped this row of motorcycles and essentially mowed them down. They were riding in pairs on that road. Route 2 in Lincoln is for a large part in Randolph that essentially goes from Twin Mountain all the way to Gorham is in a very large part of two-lane road. and
it's
much,
windy, it's narrow.
And it's really essentially, as someone who grew up in the North Country up in Berlin, it's basically the artery that makes it so difficult to bring business to the North Country because it's as you say, it's windy, it's slow. You can get behind trucks and it can really lengthen the amount of time it takes for you to either get to Berlin or Gorm or get back. And we've seen this on this road before. Nothing this horrific, but crashes invariably happen, especially in the wintertime when it's very slippery.
So what do we know about the driver's history? There seems to have been multiple reports on a checkered driving past. What do we know about that?
Yeah, well, he's only 23 years old, and he's managed to rack up quite a few violations in that time. He was convicted of DWI in 2013 when he was a minor. And because he was a juvenile, that record certainly wasn't expunged, but essentially started, it's much easier to start with a cleaner record once you become, of adult age. But, he'd had, we've been finding out as each day after the crash occurred, it seemed more and more detail was coming out about his criminal past. He'd been stopped in Connecticut for driving while intoxicated some months ago. He also was stopped twice in Texas for possession of drug paraphernalia. He was acting very strangely. There's a video that the Baytown Police Department in Texas released earlier this week showed him very agitated. According to police, they're obviously intoxicated or drugged up. They searched him. He had a crack pipe on him. As I say, there have been a lot of offenses in his past. When police came to serve the arrest warrant on him at his apartment in West Springfield, they found heroin in the apartment. They're testing it now. So he could possibly be charged with drug possession as well.
So, and one of the stories we reported at NHPR this week is that he shouldn't have had his commercial driving license. He should have had that terminated. Kevin, which of the offenses would have resulted in a termination of the commercial driver's license, and which state was responsible for terminating that?
Right, that's because of the DWI offense in Connecticut last spring. As a commercial driver, you're essentially part of a national commercial driving program. And in all states, if a commercial driver is caught for driving while intoxicated or while drugged, they lose their license. In his case, he actually refused to take a sobriety test. And that in itself is a violation subject to the suspension of his license. Now, he could, if they had suspended his license, which he holds in Massachusetts because he worked for a Massachusetts company, and that's where he originally got his license, in Massachusetts. If they suspended his license, he would be able to appeal that process and contest it and say, I really wasn't drugged. They think I was.
But it would have kept him off the road in the meantime.
Exactly. And here's where it got very bureaucratic. There is a reciprocal program across the country where all states are supposed to be exchanging all this information about commercial drivers, which, as we saw here, and as is the nature of commercial trucking, these folks cross state lines all the time. So you really have to know what their status is wherever they're going, because they may end up where you are. And Connecticut insists they provided that information to Massachusetts. Massachusetts says they didn't do it in an electronic, automatic way. We had to catch it manually. We did not. And as a result, their Registry of Motor Vehicles in Massachusetts resigned earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. So what's the next step in this case? The Massachusetts has sort of seems like they've accepted some level of responsibility if someone has resigned. He's pleaded not guilty, yes?
Yes,
and
yes.
And so he's being held in jail in the North Country. And the immigration folks are saying don't let him out, right?
Yeah, that's right. He has a green card. He's been in this country for over a decade, and So he's legally allowed to be here, but obviously this kind of conduct could make him liable to be deported. And ISIS said, we want a retainer on this guy. As they say, it's a legal retainer, which essentially means that, one, he can't leave the country if he ever gets out before this comes to trial. And two, once this case is adjudicated in some way, ICE wants to have the ability to deport him. And he would likely be deported, but it probably would only occur after he served his sentence here in New Hampshire.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, you know, Kevin gave a great overview of a lot of the legal issues that I think this individual is going to be facing for a long time to come. You know, you mentioned, Peter, at the beginning of the show, the outpouring of veterans and families around the country. We had a show of a tremendous hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 people showing up to pay their respects at a vigil. You know, Marine veterans are a very tight community to begin with, and you layer on top of that the motorcycling community. These biker groups are really kind of a central part of the community. I've read lots of interesting articles about how these biker groups are often the way in which veterans reacclimate to civilian life. And you put on top of that, New Hampshire really is a mecca for motorcycle riding. We have one of the highest per capita ownership of motorcycles in the country. We have Bike Week. We have all the great roads, winding roads that are a blast to ride on. And so it's taken on this kind of added poignancy on just the sheer carnage. And Kevin was right. Basically, the trailer seems to have blocked the lane. So they essentially ran into a wall. And they were about 15 bikes, I think, or something like that in total. And so just a tremendous tragedy. But I think you're going to see kind of a heightened interest because of the impact this has on that very tight group of Marines veterans who are also motorcycle enthusiasts.
Yeah. Shortly after the accident happened, a GoFundMe page was set up to support the families of the victims. As of Friday morning, raised $508,000 of a stated $700,000 goal. So there's that. And also, NHPR Sean Hurley has reported that the scene of the accident has been turned into kind of a memorial scene for the victims. Dozens of flags marking the spot of the accident. Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, have there been any suggestions on how to make that road, Route 2, safer? Is that applicable here?
Well, I think it certainly will be discussed. I mean, part of the problem you have, which Sean, I'm sure, provided in his reporting. I mean, we're talking about a very rural road that's just north of the Notches. A lot of the land along it is part of the White Mountain National Forest. So it's very difficult. Over the years, towns Jefferson, Randolph, Gorham, they've all examined, can we widen this road? Can we make it more navigable, easier for a lot more traffic to get there? And the answer is, in most cases, no, because you can't build more lanes on that corridor. And that's the difficult part. I also think one of the things we've not heard about yet in this case, which I submit that we will at some point, is because I know how state police operates with regard to commercial trucking. They enforce commercial trucking in this state very aggressively. I mean, it just so happened like 3 weeks before this accident, state police did an annual inspection across the state of commercial trucks in New Hampshire. And I did a story about it because I was really struck by what it found, which was 1 in 5 trucks was found to have some kind of violations, safety violations. And almost 10% of drivers were taking off the road at that time during this inspection for a number of things, including possession of drugs, drunk driving, driving too many hours in a particular day. Michael Casey with Associated Press earlier this week did a very good story about the driving performance record of this company Zukofsky worked for, Westfield Transportation of West Springfield. And it turns out a lot of violations over the last several years of the safety nature. Almost 20% of their business resulted in some kind of violation. So I think that's what we'll find, and we probably won't hear it. Much of this detail is probably being preserved for the prosecution of Zukofsky. But I submit at some point the state will aggressively look at what kind of condition was this truck in and the trailer in? Did it contribute to this horrific tragedy? And if it did, what action can we take against the company?
Fascinating detail about the way trucking laws are enforced in the state, Kevin. We're going to put a link to that AP story you mentioned at NHPR.org, which is where, listeners, you can find all of Kevin's reporting on this, all of NHPR's reporting on this as well. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We've got other stories to round up this hour, including a big one politically, and that is the budget. Both the House and Senate passed the budget along party lines. In fact, not a single GOP vote for either version. Kevin, have you seen anything like that before?
That
respect to the budget and how it was passed?
Yeah, certainly. This has kind of been many months in coming, right? When you have a democratically led legislature and a Republican governor, it seemed like both sides sort of drew their lines in the sand. We've had governors in the past 20 years. We've had two governors veto budgets. And in both cases, Republican legislatures were in charge. This is the first time Democratic legislators have been in charge with a vetoed budget.
Mm-hmm. Anna yeah. Brown, you were listening into the debate in
Absolutely.
The State House. So how would you describe it?
The Senate, it's interesting. There was almost no debate in the House, I would say, compared to the Senate, where it was very contentious. The debate went on for a long time. Senator Regina Birdsell said that Sununu is going to be our firewall. That's why the people elected him. Senator Jeb Bradley said that, you know, we're going to run into major budget deficits like we did about 10 years ago. But as you noted, it's actually not terribly catastrophic or weird or unusual to have this division, because in 2015, Hassan vetoed the budget. In 2011, zero Democratic senators and only one representative voted for what was then a Republican budget. The one thing that is interesting, though, is I did come on the exchange back in April to discuss one measure of partisanship, party unity, and it showed that the House was at a 20-year high. So I'm going to update those numbers next week, but I sort of took a peek last night, and the House is still at a 20-year high, and the Senate jumped a lot over the past 3 months. So there is partisanship going on, but it's happened before.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, what's so fascinating to me about this whole episode, and it's not all that surprising, given what we just heard, this does happen, is you know, going in just over the last few years, there's been so much agreement among Republicans and Democrats about priorities, family medical leave, mental health, education, tax relief for towns. Yet, in particular, the dynamic between this Republican governor and Democratic legislature is really one about the devil is in the details. And what this is coming down to now is a classic ideological split over fiscal policy. Sununu has drawn a line in the sand on business taxes. Democrats have drawn a line in the sand on increasing spending for various discretionary programs. You know, the Republicans argue that if you take surplus money and use it one time to bump up spending in various programs, then you've essentially created a mandate to continue spending at those new levels. And their argument now, and I think this is sort of their politically potent argument, is that this will, you know, the way that you'll, in the future, the way you'll cover that increased rate of spending is by a statewide income tax or some other kind of statewide tax. So it's interesting that with all the agreement about priorities that we've seen over the last couple of years between the two parties in this state, it just really has reverted back to a classic standoff over the different views of how you tax and spend to provide government services.
Yeah, and I think if we look going forward how this is going to resolve, so as you noted, the question, there's the debate over how are we spending the surplus, you know, is this because we've been underspending in the past, or is it because, you know, it's just a good economy and we've cut taxes? But the thing is, I think that the Democrats see that school funding ruling that just came out of the courts. They're looking to the future on that, and they acknowledge that the state is going to be on the hook for more money in one way or another. We really need to increase schools, and that's not necessarily just a Democratic priority. It's something that's coming from the courts. It's coming up local. And so where is that money going to come from? And that, I think, is going to be really where they start to hash things out over the next few months.
And I think it was reported in the Union Leader this week, Senator Dan Feltes was saying if the governor vetoes the budget, the Democrats might reset all the compromises they've already made to this point. Now,
yes.
How realistic is a threat like that?
Well, Senator Dan Feltes, as majority leader in the Senate, I think it's his job to, you know, be the bulldog for the Democrats to really advocate for that. They did take family and medical leave off the table, and I think they know that there's pretty much no chance they would get enough votes for a veto override, and they would certainly get a veto if they put something like that back in. So it's a threat, but I don't really see things like that ending up in the budget.
So we're looking at a continuing resolution, you believe?
Yeah. Well, yeah. They've already passed their
continuing. Well, they've definitely passed it, but will they need, like, depends on whether they need it. If the governor could surprise us and not veto it.
The governor could surprise us. He has surprised us in the past, but I think he's been saying this for months now. He's going to veto.
Yeah. Okay. So what will it take to break the continuing resolution and get a budget, do you think? What's the issue that's going to turn things? Kevin, do you think?
Well, continuing resolutions, we had one in 2015. We also had one in 2003 when Craig Benson, a Republican governor, was there. They really do operate in two ways. One, they provide really a cooling off period for all the sides to just take a break and reassess and look at what really matters to them and what they're willing to further compromise on. There's also kind of almost a climate change dynamic in Concord at the State House. As folks who work in the State House are aware, there's no air conditioning in the chambers of the State House. So it's unbearably hot.
So it's
going
to
bake
the legislators until they say,
and
we need to pass
and
something.
And that's one of the reasons why the House and Senate leadership basically said to Sununu, when there was talk of a continuing resolution, it's got to be 90 days. It's got to be until after Labor Day, because that's when it would be comfortable for lawmakers to come back and return to this thing. That delay actually provides a framework for an agreement, and here's why. Once you start spending at the current rate of spending, as opposed to the rate of spending under a new $13 billion budget, each day you do that, you actually save about $700,000. So if you have a continuing resolution for 90 days, that's over $60 million of spending that didn't occur in this budget, but can occur going forward. So once you sit down to discuss this compromise, the governor's acceptance of additional spending could be more accommodating than it otherwise was, because you didn't spend that money over these 3 months. In turn, the Democratic leadership could decide, do we really need to raise these business taxes in order to generate this amount of revenue? I think for Sununu, this is really a political decision.
So you're saying if it takes another 60 days, the gains the Democrats would want would essentially be moot?
Yeah. I mean, if it takes another 90 days to make this deal, the Democrats could be able to get a lot of the spending that they wanted 3 months from now from this governor. And Sununu may be able to accept that amount of spending if there isn't a business tax increase as a result. I mean, Sununu's essentially in this position. He's running for re-election, and what's he most worried about? It's not Dan Feltes running against him in 2020, although Feltes could be a potent candidate. Andrew Valinsky is another executive counselor from Concord, would be a credible candidate. He's worried about a primary challenge from the right, and he's got his father, a former White House chief of staff, whispering in his ear, I'm sure, who knows all about Republican politicians who break promises about raising taxes. George H. Bush did that, of course, when he was president, and it contributed to his Republican primary challenge from Pat Buchanan and his defeat in 92.
What's so interesting about what you just said, Kevin, is that, you know, traditionally we tend to separate out New Hampshire gubernatorial contests from the larger partisan context of running for the House or running for the Senate or running for president. And we talk a lot about how, you know, New Hampshire governors kind of are slightly right of center or slightly left of center, and they really want those independent voters. You know, you're New Hampshire's governor. You're not a Republican governor or Democrat. This kind of moves away from that a little bit. And this seems, you know, it's kind of, I think, reflective of the larger polarization in the political culture. So there's a clear strategy there, and it might work, but it might not.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, NHPR's Casey McDermott's going to join us to share some of her reporting on how the New Hampshire House of Representatives is improving in one measure when it comes to attendance. I'm Peter Biello, and we will be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And before we get back to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, I want to let you know that instead of the Exchange next week, you're going to hear at 9 a.m. a special series, Writers on a New England Stage, interviews with prominent authors produced by NHPR in partnership with the Music Hall, recorded live at the Historic Theater at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. So tune in every morning at 9 and again at 7 next week to hear those conversations. But right now, we're talking about the news of the week with our panelists. In the studio with me are Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And joining us for this part of the program is NHPR's Casey McDermott. Welcome, Casey.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been doing some reporting this week. I want to talk to you about these stories you've been writing. And, of course, you've been following the issue of attendance among New Hampshire lawmakers for quite some time now. Before we get into what you found this week, tell us about how you got interested in this in the first place.
Sure. So if people were following the State House last year, they may have noticed this kind of, you know, casual conversation, just observing that there were a lot of empty seats on any given day. So as the session was winding down in 2018, I figured, you know, we have a way of actually looking at this. The legislature keeps track of attendance records, at least on roll call votes. So those are the votes where everyone has to attach a specific yay, nay, to their decision as opposed to a voice vote or some kind of other floor action. So I pulled the data from the legislature's website and did see that compared to past years, last year's attendance was pretty grim.
What does grim mean?
So grim means that on any given day, at least 46 of 400 House seats were empty. Now, some of those were because of ongoing vacancies, but many of them were just because people weren't showing up for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And that can include, you know, these are citizen legislators, as we often remind people, they make only $100 a year. That's not exactly always enough to justify taking time off of their paying jobs, their full-time jobs. It's not always easy for them to, if they're young parents, line up childcare. Obviously, life happens. People are dealing with illnesses, family issues, things like that. So there are a variety of reasons to explain those absences. But, you know, it is a matter of public interest. People elect their legislators because they expect them to show up for the job. So we wanted to create a way for people to better understand the rate at which they were doing that.
Okay. And so how much better are they doing now?
Pretty well. So if you look at it overall, the class of 2019 had on average, higher attendance for floor votes and fewer unexcused absences than any other year for which we have data dating back to 2011. Now, one caveat is that for whatever reason, I was having trouble tracking down the records for 2015. So we'll just have to set that aside, keep that in mind. But generally speaking, they were doing pretty well. So they beat last year's attendance record in terms of the highest attendance. So 385 was the highest number of legislators.
That is very close.
That was present this year. So meaning that there were only 15 empty seats that day. Generally speaking, there were fewer representatives who were out for an extended period of time. Only 7 people missed more than 60% of the votes, which sounds like a lot. It is. But compared to last year, again, the numbers were higher. This year, 55 representatives had perfect attendance. So that means, again, missing no roll call votes. And we didn't factor in, I should say, you know, committee attendance. That's a whole nother system. And that's also a very important part of the legislative process, or other floor actions that may not have been recorded in the same way that roll call votes were. Mm-hmm. One other thing that we looked at, and we looked at this last year, too, because I wanted to kind of figure out a way to assess, you know, it's one thing to have empty seats, but it's another thing for that to actually impact the outcome of a vote. So one way that I came up with to look at that was I took, you know, the deciding margin on a roll call vote. So the difference between yays and nays. And then I looked at how many times the number of absent representatives was greater than that margin. So that's not to say that that definitely would have impacted the outcome, but that
it
is
had the potential.
It had the potential to, depending on who those representatives were. And if you look at last year in 2018, that margin was smaller than the number of absent representatives about 60% of the time on roll call votes. So that's a pretty, you know, significant number of votes where that was the case. Now, this year, that happened only 12% of the time. So that could have to do with, you know, the partisan makeup of the House. It could have to do with a lot of things. But again, just, you know, that's one lens through which we can understand the actual, you know, implications of the absences.
So, Casey, do you have a sense of why things have improved attendance-wise this year, or is this just kind of by chance?
I think it's a mix. I will say that I heard, you know, as I was going back to re-report the story this year, I did hear from a number of people who said that, you know, we looked at the story that you guys did last year, and I think that people, you know, either campaigned on those numbers if they saw that people were not showing up, or campaigned on the idea that they were going to show up more. But I do think, just, you know, generally speaking, I think that the issue got a lot of attention in general, not just from NHPR, but from other local news outlets. So I think it's something that was on people's minds as they were campaigning, and also as they came to Concord and you know, kind of pledged to their constituents that they were going to try to make an effort to be there more frequently.
And for voters who are interested in figuring out how their particular legislator did attendance-wise, they can check NHPR.org,
yep. Yes? Yeah, so this was actually another thing that we wanted to do. We wanted to make it easier for people to look up their legislators' attendance rates. So again, we took the information. This is the same information that you would be able to find on the House website. We just wanted to make it a little bit easier to navigate. And then we also converted it into kind of an attendance rate. So we, you know, just made it into percentages, so you can see that, you know, Representative so-and-so was absent, you know, 5% of the time, 2% of the time, 60% of the time. But then you can also see the raw numbers behind that. And we include links to the original records as well.
All right, Casey. Two representatives put forward a bill aiming to study the economic challenges of employed persons serving in the state legislature. What happened to that bill?
It actually died in the Senate. Oh. So I talked to two of the representatives. This was actually a group of a bipartisan group of lawmakers, many of them first-time lawmakers. We heard a lot about new, relatively young people coming into the legislature this year, and with them, you know, bringing the perspective that may not have been represented in large numbers before, of working parents, again, or working professionals, or in some cases, people who are still either in undergraduate or graduate school, and balancing those responsibilities with their role in the legislature. And I think that provoked or continued a conversation about, is it realistic in the current structure within the legislature to expect people to be able to serve if they have all those outside obligations, and what could they do to make it a little bit more accessible for people who may reflect those perspectives in the legislature. So there was this proposal to create a study committee to look at, quote, the economic challenges of employed persons serving in the New Hampshire legislature. That proposal did get a green light from the House, but died in the Senate. That being said, the people that are working on it say that they still want to look at this, even if they don't have, you know, a formal mandate or a formal study committee. They're looking at seeing if they can study ways to bring remote work into the legislature, which I think, you know, raises some more questions about how would you, you know, ensure that people are still able to participate? How would you ensure that, you know, the process continues to be fair? But it does raise some interesting questions. And one of the things I heard talking to one of the lawmakers that's involved in this is that, look, there's a lot of stuff that the business world uses to make sure that people can participate fully in meetings or in discussions or things like that. And that basically kind of the state house is really kind of archaic in a lot of ways in terms of how it goes about even just simple kind of scheduling.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about another story that you've been reporting on, Casey, and that's that the Legislative Ethics Committee has voted to pursue a preliminary investigation into a complaint against New Hampshire House Majority Leader Doug Lay. He's a Democrat from Jaffrey who also leads one of the state's largest teachers unions. What is the complaint, Casey?
Sure. So just to step back for a moment,
sure.
The Legislative Ethics Committee last year was asked by a Republican lawmaker, Greg Hill, whether it would be acceptable for him to accept a job with the Children's Scholarship Fund, which is an organization that often gets involved on education policy matters, and that he, had worked with or encountered in his work on education policy, Representative Hill. The Legislative Ethics Committee in that case told Representative Hill that he could take the position that that in and of itself would not be a violation of ethics rules, but if he did that, he would not be able to sponsor, vote on, or participate in basically any legislative action pertaining to that organization. So that's the backdrop through which they are now being asked, the Ethics Committee, to consider this situation involving the House Majority Leader, Representative Doug Lay. So Representative Lay has served as the president of American Federation of Teachers New Hampshire for the last several years. In that position, he does not recuse himself from votes affecting the teachers union. He has testified repeatedly on, you know, to convey the union's positions in committee hearings. So it becomes very difficult, I think, to and I've had a number of conversations with him where I've tried to kind of figure out where he draws the line between his role as a representative and his role as head of this union. And so basically, the Ethics Committee is looking at whether he has violated any ethics rules by letting those two roles blend too closely together, or, you know, failing to recuse himself from votes that could directly affect the same union that employs him.
And if the committee determines that there was, in fact, a violation, what might be the consequences?
So there are a number of consequences. Every case is kind of different. It's really up to the Ethics Committee to evaluate and to look at the circumstances behind each individual case. I should say as well that, so basically, the complaint was filed. They first considered it, I think, in April. Since then, they have been, until this week, in what was called an initial review of the complaint. At this week's meeting, they voted to move forward to a preliminary investigation. So that just gives you a sense of the pace at which this is likely to move. It's likely to be a long process. It's technically supposed to be confidential right now, but we at NHPR were able to confirm both the substance and the status of the complaint, both because the person who filed it posted about the complaint publicly, and then we were able to follow up to confirm, you know, information from there. But the process is likely to move forward in the next few months. And from here, the Ethics Committee will basically decide whether to dismiss it or whether to continue with either what's called an informal resolution. So that might be them, you know, sending the lawmaker a letter and saying, here's what you did, here's what you need to do to fix it. Or they might take it a step further and go forward with some kind of formal proceeding, which would include like a hearing, other more kind of official inquiries from here.
NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much for talking about your stories. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, listeners, you can find these stories at nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, the Balsams Resort, a historic grand hotel in Dixville Notch, has gone up for sale. The developers working to restore the hotel have struggled to find funding. Developers estimate that phase one of the redevelopment project would cost $173 million. Also, a private water company, utility company, is getting pushback for its plans to build a major commercial well in Hampstead. The Hampstead Area Water Company wants a permit from the state to build a new well to supply water to its customers in the region. At a meeting on Wednesday night, residents said they want more public oversight over the water company and for the state to lower how much water it can pump per year. If approved by the Department of Environmental Services, the well could be built this fall. Let's look at a few other statehouse issues before we head into a break. Yesterday, the Democratic House and Senate passed bills raising the minimum wage and establishing gun-free zones. So let's first of all talk about the minimum wage increase. Again, Anna Brown, no GOP votes on this, yes?
Correct. So the minimum wage bill, there were a few different ones this year that the House and Senate were debating, but they all sort of gathered around the concept of raising it to $12 an hour by 2022. And that did go through. The tipped minimum wage is going to remain 45% of that. So that'll also go up, but it won't be a separate increase like that they had debated. Sununu's probably going to veto. Governor Sununu has basically said he thinks the federal minimum wage is where this should happen, that at the state level, you know, we should just rely on the federal government, and whether or not you think the minimum wage should go up or not, it shouldn't be us doing it. So he's probably going to veto that, and they're not going to have the votes to override.
Yeah, I would most definitely say that he'll veto it. I remember I've mentioned this before, the right after he was reelected, he was on the exchange, and Laura Kanoy asked him about the minimum wage legislation and would he raise the minimum wage, and his answer was simply, now why would I do that? And he proceeded to lay out an argument about how it would damage New Hampshire's economy. There are a few issues, either nationally or locally, that are more of a litmus test between Republicans and Democrats than minimum wage legislation. Republicans just do not typically sign on to increases in the minimum wage, and so I would be surprised if he didn't veto this.
And speaking of litmus tests for party loyalty here, the gun-free school zone bill, House Bill 564, forbids unauthorized individuals from carrying guns into schools, with the exception of law enforcement and some others. Pretty much guaranteed the governor's going to veto this as well, yes?
Right. The interesting thing on this one is the Senate amended it at one point so that it would just be up to local school districts to decide if they were going to ban firearms or implement some other firearms policy. But the House and Senate Conference Committee came together and got rid of that and said, yeah, it's going to be a statewide ban, which I think, you know, maybe they could have slipped if it was a local control thing. Maybe Sununu might have gotten on board on that. But I think a statewide ban, you know, when you're going back to the debates in November 2018, he was saying, you know, no, that's not going to help our schools.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, we'll talk about Gordon McDonald. He's making his bid to be Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. We'll hear about the arguments he made before the Executive Council this week. Also, Senator Jeanne Shaheen has a challenger for re-election in 2020. We'll get to know a little bit about him and a few takeaways from our panelists on the two giant Democratic primary debates this week. Stay with us.
Recently on The Exchange, transgender panelists answer a listener's question about how to talk about those times before their child transitioned.
Just because they've come out as trans does not lessen that experience. Do you still own those memories? And I would say to any parent, those memories are yours, of your child. It's just being thoughtful both to what you need as a parent and understanding that your first priority is to make sure that your child is loved.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Weekday mornings at 9, only on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Union Leader reporter Kevin Landrigan, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. So let's start this part of the program talking about Attorney General Gordon McDonald. He faced a hearing as Governor Sununu's nominee for Chief Justice. He addressed concerns over his involvement in conservative Republican politics and what that might mean for abortion rights. He sought to quell those concerns, and this audio is from WMUR.
It is settled law. As a judge, I would be bound by Roe versus Wade, and it would be my duty to uphold it.
So that's addressing one concern about him. And we have a question from Tom, who emailed from Exeter. Why would someone without judicial experience be nominated to the New Hampshire Supreme Court? Tom follows, doesn't seem to be a wise decision, does it? I think Tom meant it as rhetorical, but I think that question might have an answer. Anna?
Well, I think that, you know, they posed that very question to Gordon McDonald, and he talked about his leadership responsibilities as the Attorney General, because the idea is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court isn't just sitting on the court. They're also responsible for the judicial branch as a whole. So I think that's the argument. It's a fair point, though, because he's going to be the first in at least a century to be Chief Justice without having served as a judge. So, you know, you have to decide what's important to do. It's certainly been a choice of Sununu's more than once now. He's the third appointee that wasn't serving as a judge before.
You know, it's interesting when we do the national Supreme Court confirmation battles, there always is this period where, you know, people are brainstorming about nominees and they mention people who maybe have never actually been on the court, you know, maybe from the political world or the university world or somewhere else. And in the end, they always come back to typically somebody from the Court of Appeals moving up to the next step. So this is unusual.
Yeah, it certainly is. I think, it's sort of what happens with midterm elections, right? Democrats won everything but this corner office. And it just so happens, you know, Chris Sununu is governor in only a second term, and he gets to basically stack the court. I mean, with three nominations of five on the court, these folks serve until the mandatory retirement age of 70. So a lot of governors never get a Supreme Court nomination. And just by luck of draw, he gets three. He picks three who not only don't have any judicial experience, they also do have experience in Republican Party politics. And that's also what really grates Democrats.
And I think it's worth noting that if you look at one of the controversial things to happen in the Supreme Court lately, it was when they issued an opinion on a voting rights bill before Governor Sununu was going to sign or veto. They went to the Supreme Court to just sort of advise us, like, is this constitutional or not? So three of the judges said, yeah, this stands up to constitutional muster. And two said, we can't weigh in. There's not enough facts here. There's not a court case before us. Well, the ones who said, no, we'll go ahead and weigh in were the ones who didn't have judicial experience in the past. So it's going to make a difference on these issues.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what difference, but
exactly.
Your point taken.
Yes.
Like they do think
it,
differently.
It will happen, yeah.
Yeah, so executive council has a Democratic majority, 3-2. What does that bode for his confirmation? Anna, your thoughts?
Well, we have to remember that there was massive support for the Attorney General Gordon McDonald at this hearing. It was like, I read in the newspaper one coverage, it was something like 3-1 in terms of people who support him and people who oppose him. And that includes the current Supreme Court justices. So I think that probably realistically he is going to go through. I don't see there being any big red roadblocks here.
And Dean Spiliotis, are these judicial appointments generally politically charged here in New Hampshire?
It's interesting. I was thinking about that very issue as I was listening to the discussion. And, traditionally the way judicial appointments have functioned both at the state level and the national level is if you are an elected official and you do not agree with a particular ideology of the judge, as long as they are qualified, you don't make a decision about their partisanship or their ideology. You make a decision about their ability to carry out their judicial activities, and that was traditionally how it was done at the federal level. That's now gone pretty much, and it's traditionally how it's been done at the state level. And I think McDonald seems to be kind of aware of that particular pitfall, and I think some of his responses at the hearing were geared towards allaying some concerns. But there's no doubt that over the last 10 or 20 years, judicial nominations, both federally and locally, have been folded into the larger partisan polarization. And that's, there are plenty of examples in history where, liberal members of Congress voted for, of the Senate, voted for a pretty conservative justice because they were qualified, even if they didn't actually agree with them. But we've moved away from that style of confirmation. So this seems to be more the new way that things are getting done.
Also in the news this week, retired Brigadier General Don Bolduc is running for U.S. Senate. Bolduc is the first Republican to challenge incumbent Democrat Jean Shaheen for her bid for a third term. Here he is launching his campaign at the Concord VFW, as reported by NHPR's Josh Rogers.
This is not a situation I envisioned myself in at this time. I am anything but a politician, but like many Americans today, I am ticked off by the partisan mindset on display in Washington, D.C.
Getting a sense of who General Bolduc is there, but what do we know about General Bolduc?
We know a lot about him, but he's not particularly well known at this point. He's a retired brigadier general, a Laconia native. He spent 36 years in the Army, 10 tours in Afghanistan. He's never run for office. As you mentioned with the clip from Josh, he launched his campaign at the Concord VFW, which kind of fits into the theme of him being an advocate for veterans and veteran mental health and PTSD. He says he's conservative. There's a lot of talk now, and Bill O'Brien, the former conservative speaker of the New Hampshire State House of Representatives, has said he's got a big announcement coming up in July. He's probably going to run. That'll make for a very interesting Republican primary. I think Democrats probably wouldn't admit it, but I think when Governor Sununu said he was not going to run against Jean Shaheen for Senate, they breathed a bit of a sigh of relief. Now they're just going to kind of watch these guys kind of fight it out in a Republican primary. Jean Shaheen, under any situation, is going to be difficult to unseat. She's building up a significant war chest. She's incredibly experienced and seasoned campaigner, and she has a lot of support among independents. Now, maybe Bolduc is somebody who he's a little bit less known. He's not as polarizing as Bill O'Brien. Maybe he could pull in some of those independents. But I think Democrats feel a lot more comfortable about this in comparison to what would have been essentially a huge battle between Sununu and Shaheen.
Anna Brown.
Yes, I do think that it'll be an interesting choice if because O'Brien, Bill O'Brien, former House Speaker, we do think he is going to jump in. He's all but said it because it is sort of that far right, potentially far right versus moderate, because I do see Bolduc so far as coming in as more of that moderate. He one of his first talking points was about student loan debt, which is not something you'll see emphasized by a lot of really conservative Republicans at this point. There was also a letter that surfaced that he wrote to the Daily Beast website about the resignation of General John Mattis as Secretary of Defense, which he was very critical of the administration in Washington. And so people have come out and said, oh, he was criticizing President Trump, which, of course, you could get some heat from the far right for that. But I also know that in general, you know, he's a man in the military, and everyone I've talked to in the military absolutely loved General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. So, you know, it makes sense he wrote that letter.
Also in the news this week, physician assistants soon will be able to prescribe medical marijuana in New Hampshire. Governor Kristi Noem has signed a bill expanding the list of providers who may prescribe the drug. Another bill would allow medical marijuana users to grow their own plants. That awaits his signature. The state won't be legalizing recreational use of marijuana anytime soon. The House passed a bill legalizing recreational use in April, but the Senate later voted to delay action on it. Also, a story worth mentioning as the weather heats up. A New Hampshire man has been accused of leaving his dog inside a vehicle in temperatures that reached over 106 degrees. The Nashua Telegraph reports 67-year-old Wesley Golem of Deerfield faces a misdemeanor animal cruelty charge. The vehicle's windows were allegedly slightly open, but police got a high temperature reading. Golem returned to the vehicle, told police he was in the mall for only a short period of time, but police said it was about 40 minutes. Golem is scheduled to appear in court later this month. So before we close the program, I did want to take the temperature of the room here on the debates, these super long multi-candidate debates this week. Maybe we'll start with you, Anna, about who you think really benefited from these debates and who do you think sort of lost points?
Well, I think that Buttigieg definitely showed that he can stand up on the stage with these candidates. Because
Pete Buttigieg, South Bend,
Indiana.
Yes,
Mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's having a little surge here in the polls, as we all know. But I think the important test last night was when you put him on the same stage as these other, quote unquote, mainstream candidates. Does he hold his own? And I think he did really well in terms of the losers. I think Biden and Sanders did not do as well. Certainly, they were getting attacked. They had the most room to fall.
Yeah.
They were, there were big targets on them because they're the front runners. But I also think, Biden sort of missed the question in terms of there was said, raise your hand if your health care plan would cover illegal immigrant or undocumented immigrants. And Biden did not raise his hand. But then when questioned about it, he said, I did raise my hand. Well, there are photos. He didn't raise his hand. You know, so he looked a little not quite on his A game on the stage. And Sanders, I think it didn't play so well in the beginning when they asked him, OK, to pay for your health care, would you raise taxes on the middle? Would middle class be paying higher taxes? And he tap danced around it. And I think he could have just said, yes, I'll raise taxes, but they'll be paying way less for their health care.
So you're referring to the Thursday night debate. How about the Wednesday night? Did you watch that one?
I did watch Wednesday night debate, and I think that because there weren't the clear front runners so much on that stage, Elizabeth Warren was there. She's been doing well, but you didn't have the big juggernauts of Biden and Sanders. I think it came out a bit more as a wash. I thought that it was interesting that several of the candidates spoke Spanish, and I also thought it was interesting that they were reading out of the same playbook as Democrats in New Hampshire in 2018. We need an economy that works for everyone. That was something that Molly Kelly said. And you heard Beto O'Rourke and some of the other candidates say the exact same words. That's definitely a message that I think might be resonating for New Hampshire voters.
Lots of talk about paid family medical leave.
As well, yeah. You definitely saw the national and state debates are echoing each other.
Yeah. So, Kevin, who do you think, winners, losers from both Wednesday and Thursday night debates?
Well, I think, one thing, with that many candidates, they obviously get a lot less time than they otherwise would in a smaller debate. I also think that we generally tend to overestimate the bump that candidates get from a good or bad debate performance. It's just a kind of snapshot in time. But Kamala Harris, U.S. Senator from California, I thought showed her props as a former prosecutor. She was extremely aggressive with Joe Biden, scored some really big points, I think did very well. On Wednesday, there were lesser-known candidates, I think, who kind of edged their way into the discussion. Julian Castro, the former HUD secretary, San Antonio mayor, really went after Beto O'Rourke, I think, effectively on a very progressive liberal issue about decriminalizing people who illegally immigrate into this country. Bill de Blasio, the New York City mayor, who folks really haven't paid any attention to, got into this race very late, managed to also mix it up quite a bit on very progressive issues, including Medicare for All, which he supports. That was one of the observations I had while I'm watching the debate. It's 2019. You got 10 candidates on the stage, and they can't turn the mics off for people who aren't supposed to be speaking.
It could have gone a lot worse, you know, I think, but yeah.
But you could see the moderators, particularly on that second night, really had difficulty keeping decorum, because on the first night, the monkey see, monkey do. These candidates saw, who were on the debate stage Thursday, they saw people on Wednesday, like de Blasio, interrupting a whole lot and not getting penalized for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, can I do a little interrupting here myself,
sure.
Just because
yeah.
we have to end the show,
yeah.
but I do want to hear from Dean on who he, what his takeaways were from both nights.
Sure.
Thank you, Kevin, though. I appreciate your insights.
Yeah, no, just real quickly, I think the big question going into these two nights was, to what extent are the other candidates, particularly those in the progressive wing of the party, going to go after Joe Biden as the front runner? As I've said before on the show, there's tremendous frustration among progressives that Biden continues to have this lead where he's up in the mid-30s. And the other candidates are down in the teens. And as we saw on the much more raucous debate night last night, other candidates went after him, I think, more directly than maybe people expected. You know, the first night, I think Elizabeth Warren did a fine job of kind of maintaining her momentum. I thought Senators Booker and Klobuchar were solid. Julian Castro may get another look. But that second night, I think everything is going to be swamped by this back and forth between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden over his segregation comments and his opposition to busing. And she brought in a very personal anecdote about her own experience as a child. That has kind of dominated everything. And that may almost kind of obscure any progress that was made on that first night. Also, Pete Buttigieg continued to get good reviews. I find him to be very good at sort of an economy of words. He's very efficient in how he answers questions. So that's my quick take.
Well, listeners, we're conducting a survey of issues that are important to you in this primary campaign. So you can participate by going to nhpr.org and clicking on NHPR Primary 2020. So we got to wrap up. There's always more to talk about than we have time to talk about it, but I want to thank everybody for being here today. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landergan, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Anna Brown, director of research and analysis at Citizens Count. Thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Great to be here. Yeah,
thanks, Peter.
Have a great weekend.
And remember, listeners, you can follow the stories that we talked about today at nhpr.org. We'll post links there. You can also keep the conversation going on Facebook, where you can watch a live video of this broadcast. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Rebecca Lavoie is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.